Today's Teisho will be on case 16 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 16, when the bell sounds. Umon said, the world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell? Mumon's comment. In studying Zen, you should not be swayed by sounds and forms. Even though you attain insight when hearing a voice or seeing a form, this is simply the ordinary way of things. Don't you know that real Zen students command sounds, control forms, are clear-sighted at every event and free on every occasion? Granted you are free, just tell me, does the sound come to the ear or does the ear go to the sound? If both sound and silence die away at such a juncture, how could you talk of Zen? While listening with your ear, you cannot tell. When hearing with your eye, you are truly intimate. Mumon's verse. With realization, things make one family. Without realization, they are separated in a thousand ways. Without realization, things make one family. With realization, things are separated in a thousand ways. Thank everybody for coming here this morning on this beautiful September morning to practice Zen. You know, this koan is rather simple on the surface. In a Zen temple, people's lives are regulated by a bell. And this is true in Sesshin also. If you've been to one of our sesshin, we have quite a rigorous schedule. So at sesshin, we get up at 4:30 in the morning, and usually somebody goes up and down the hallways at 4:30 with the clappers, and hits them, and that's the signal for everybody to get up. And then by 5 o'clock, people have to get into the zendo, into the Zen hall, and sit down and be prepared for sutra recitation. And we do sutra recitation, and then we have tea, and then we have a bathroom break, and then at 6 o'clock we start sitting. And in 25 minutes we have I ring the bell, and people can take a break, stretch, and then another sit, and started with a bell and ended with a bell, and then so on until 8 o'clock, and then there's a bell to eat. Yeah. So this goes on all day long. The whole day is punctuated by the sound of the bell, and it's highly structured. You know, Zen practice at a sesshin is highly structured, and also, it's even more difficult if you have to put on robes. Traditional robes in Chinese Zen, would have involved seven different items, seven different pieces that all have to be worn properly. So you have to put on the robes carefully and correctly, and you have to take them off carefully and correctly. Any little thing is troublesome. So, if you have to go to the bathroom, for example, you have to take off all this stuff and go to the bathroom. And then you have to put it all back on. During the work period, people don't work in traditional Zen or Chan. People don't work in their robes. They're actually clothes people wear for doing work. They look more like pajamas. People have to go during the samu or work period and take off their seven-piece robe and put on the pajamas and go out and rake leaves or whatever. And then when it's time to sit again, you have to come in, take off the pajamas, put on the robes, and so on. So it's all kind of a pain in the ass, you know. It could be simplified in a lot of ways. And there are many things in Zen that are like that, that could be made simpler or easier. And so the koan is sort of getting at this. It's saying, in a general way, it's saying, look, you know, this is a big world. It's Saturday morning. You could have done a lot of things this morning, you know. You could have gotten in your car and gone into New York. You could have gone out to Pennsylvania to hike. You could have met your friends at a restaurant, you know. But you came here, you know. When you come here, of course, there's a lot of work involved, right? It's a lot of work. So the world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell? Why are you living this way, you know? So it's really about, this is really a koan about practicing Zen in general, and it's also about the way we practice Zen in particular, because everything we do is not necessarily the easiest way to do things, you know. It's a highly structured life. So, that's the koan. A friend of mine, who's also a student of Zen in our group, wrote me a letter recently. And he has gone to Japan, and he's teaching English in Japan. And he wrote me a letter, and he said, I'm so happy to be in Japan, and I'm going to all these beautiful temples and having a wonderful time, and a strange thing has happened to me. He said, I've really started sitting again with great energy and joy. And he said, I didn't tell you this earlier, but my practice has been sort of running out of energy or running out of steam. He said, I haven't known why, but I just didn't have any life or any energy in my practice. And he said, all of a sudden I'm sitting every day because I want to, and I'm enjoying my sits. And he also said something else. He said he had gone to the summer sesshin, which we have early summer sesshin, which is in June. And he said he really wanted to have a breakthrough with his koan. He really wanted to enter higher level of insight, you know, breakthrough to enlightened mind. So he really pushed himself very, very hard. He sat every sit full lotus almost. And in his letter to me, he said that he was on the breakfast crew, so he was helping to prepare the breakfast, and he said when he would come in the morning after really three periods of meditation to fix the breakfast, he would be shivering, shaking, with his body would just be shaking. If you do something very, very strenuous, you know, like you know, if you push yourself a little too hard, sometimes you can find yourself shivering or shaking, you know. Especially those of you who have a background in athletics, you know, you can, if you run a race and you push yourself a little too hard, sometimes you have muscle cramps or you have a lot of pain, and you just sort of run through your pain, but at the end, you know, you can be kind of, you can be shaking. So he said, you know, at the end of the sitting period in the mornings, a couple times he would just be literally like shaking or trembling. And he said, when I left the sesshin, when I left the retreat, he said, my mind in past retreats, at past sesshins, when I've left, has been very good. Very, my mind's been very clear. I've been very happy. I've been very, feel much better. He said, but this time, at the end of this retreat, he said, my mind was very sour, he said. I thought that was an interesting choice of words. He said, I felt that my mind was very sour. And I can't remember what else, that word sticks with me, but basically it was like he felt sort of burned out, sour and burned out. And but he said, you know, now all of a sudden I find that I'm able to practice again with great joy. You know, I actually get up automatically in the morning, and I find myself enjoying my sits. So that was his letter to me. And I thought that the letter was there's so much wisdom in that letter, you know. This is a person who's been practicing Zen for maybe 3 years, something like that. And he's learning how to practice, you know, how to practice. And he's learning the way everybody has to learn. You know, we pretty much learn by trial and error. We all sort of have to learn that way. You know, when people come to Zen practice, we don't necessarily have much experience with doing something like Zen. You know, people come here on Monday and Friday night for the beginner's night. Last night we had 40 people. It was quite a crowd. And people had heard about our group, or they had read one of our pamphlets, or Professor Dao Zhang in the religion, Eastern Religions class, had sent some of his students, or invited some of his students to come and attend. So we got quite a crowd, and people have never done this before, you know. And who knows what they think is going to happen, you know. They come in and they sit down, and I teach them how to sit in this crazy posture, right? And I tell them to straighten the back and breathe through the abdomen. And, you know, watch the breath. And who knows what ideas they have, you know. Maybe they think they will see lights, or, you know, levitate, or, you know, magic power, you know, some kind of energy will descend on them, you know. Maybe not. You know, they probably don't have those kinds of ideas. But, you know, they're waiting for something to happen, you know. And you know, it's probably kind of a shock to them when they're watching the breath and watching the breath, and they just realize how distracted the mind ordinarily is. You know, how it's kind of a shock. I myself had read quite a few books on Zen and on Buddhism in general before I started practicing. And I had read a lot of other stuff too. You know, I was anthropology, double major in English and anthropology, and my interest was anthropology of religion. So I read a lot of stuff on different cultures and their rituals, and I read there was a very popular book at this time called The Yaqui Way of Knowledge, The Teachings of Don Juan. And the Don Juan was supposed to be a shaman, like a holy man, among the Yaqui Indians in Mexico. And the author was a man named Carlos Castaneda, who was a young anthropology student at the University of California. And he claimed to have met Don Juan by accident at a bus stop. So Don Juan, it turns out, took a peyote, which is a kind of cactus, and hallucinatory chemicals in the cactus. And the books were all about these mysterious adventures that Carlos Castaneda would have with Don Juan, you know, where coyotes would talk to them. And when they took the peyote, they would have conversations with animals. They could walk across water. They could jump off high cliffs and not be killed. You know? So I read this stuff and I thought, oh, this is so cool. You know? Sign me up, right? So many people go to Mexico now, by the way. I myself went to Mexico, and I was partly looking for Don Juan, believe it or not. I did take the bus all over Mexico. I never found Don Juan, and I did find hundreds of Americans looking for Don Juan. And indeed, so many people go now to the area where the Yaqui Indians live that the Mexican government is very, very worried about an ecological disaster. People are digging up all the cactuses, and peyote cactuses have become so difficult, they're worried that they might actually go extinct. And the Yaquis do use these for their rituals. So they're very worried also, because their whole religion is based upon this this cactus. So anyway, you know, when I started sitting, I had a lot of crazy ideas about what was going to happen on the cushion. And even though sitting is a little bit challenging, you know, you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath and you realize how distracted your mind is, I kept thinking that this was going to be sort of a short-term thing. You know, initially my idea was that I was going to get into Zen, I was going to practice and have enlightenment, and you know, maybe if you had asked me to predict how long, I would have said, oh, a couple of years. In fact, I honestly did say that. I had forgotten all about that, but I had said to one of my friends that if I could just practice Zen seriously, I'm sure I could have enlightenment in a couple of years. So you know, people come here on a Monday night or a Friday night, and I imagine they might not be as kind of crazy as I was, but they probably have either they're just here on kind of like you know, just to see what this is all about, or they might have expectations. And either way, it's probably a shock when they realize how distracted their minds are. And sometimes, I don't always say this to people, but sometimes I tell them that if you're going to practice Zen, it's probably going to take you know, around 10 years. And actually, you know, that's not the truth. It takes 10 years to get really good at this, you know? Yeah, so I might as well be honest with you. It takes about 10 years to be a serious Zen student. So by this I mean, it takes about 10 years for your mind to develop the stability it requires to reach deep, deep samadhi, and to really begin to work through your karmic obstacles, and to have deep experience of awakened mind in the moment. So, we all have a lot of karma to work through. I didn't know this when I started. I didn't realize that. This was going to be a long haul, you know, that doing Zen is a long haul, and that it's really about encountering a lot of obstacles in ourselves. And I didn't realize that either, you know. So I honestly thought that at some point my teacher was going to give me like secret instructions. I really did. I thought possibly I was going to go into the Dokusan room and Genki Roshi was going to say, now do this, this, and this, you know, and I'd get back on the cushion and boom, everything would disappear, you know, I'd be in another dimension or something like that. And of course that never happened. Instead, you know, when I would sit on the cushion, I would have to struggle with my body. I would have to, you know, it took me a long time to be able to sit comfortably on the cushion. It took me a couple of years. I started sitting in the Burmese position, and then I started sitting half lotus, and after maybe 3 years I started sitting full lotus. But I could never get my left leg properly up on my right thigh. And so when I would pull my left foot up on my right thigh, after a while it would start to tremble, you know. Because I guess it's a little, that leg is a little short. Somehow the muscles would be stretched and strained, and it would start to vibrate on my thigh. And so to compensate, I would lean forward, right, to shorten that muscle, and sort of lean to one side, to the left. And then it would stop the vibration in my foot, but I'd be over tilted forward and to the left, yeah? And so in our temple, there was a person called a Jiki Jitsu whose job was to straighten people up. And so pretty much at every sit, you know, I would get straightened up. And the Jiki Jitsu would grab my shoulders and pull me over and straighten me up. And of course then I would sit there for a while and my foot would start to vibrate, you know. And honestly, the sweat would run off my brow, you know. I'd be sitting there sweating. And then pretty soon I would just sort of gently start tilting back over, right? This went on for years and years. A friend of my second teacher named Hirano Katsufumi. Hirano Katsufumi was the head of training at Eheiji, which is the biggest training temple in Japan. And thousands of monks, it's like the Harvard of Zen in Japan. So if you're going to be a monk in Japan, a Zen monk, you in the Soto tradition, you go through Eheiji. And if you went through Eheiji, you had to take a Zen instruction with Hirano Katsufumi. And he was a monster, in my opinion, you know. I mean, in the traditional Zen, we have a stick we call the keisaku, or kyosaku. And in American Zen, it sits on the altar, and people request it. So the Jiki Jitsu goes up and down the aisle, and he straightens everybody's posture. And if people want to be struck with the stick, you're hit with the stick. See, so you bow, and then you lean forward, and you have to get in a certain posture. You put your hand on the ground, and you bend over, and most people have a rather meaty area of muscles on their back. And the stick is flat, like a paddle on the end, and it's made out of like a pine-type wood. So it's... when the Jiki Jitsu hits you with the stick, it hits that meaty part of your back, you know. And so it makes quite a loud slap. It would be like if somebody hit you with a ping pong paddle or something like that. It would really sound terrible, right? And indeed, it does hurt quite a bit, but it's a stings. It's like getting slapped, you know. So basically, the Jiki Jitsu goes up and down these aisles, and in America, you can request to be, so many people in the morning, if they're very tired, they lean forward and they request their morning slaps with the keisaku, you know. So you'll hear these people, you'll hear the Jiki Jitsu will be going up and down the aisle, and you'll hear this, And then that's one side, see? Then he does the other side. See? And this goes on and on. And I find it very distracting, you know? So we actually don't do it, and everybody sits very well. But in fact, I think it's not necessary at all, you know? But in Japan, it's not voluntary, right? The jikijitsu is not like your friend. He's like the drill sergeant, right? So when Hirano came to sit, he would come to visit our temple, he would be given the keisaku in honor of his visit. And he's the drill sergeant at Eheiji. So he would come by, he would see me sitting there, and my foot would start, you know, jikijitsu goes to the end of, he starts at the altar, he walks down each row, stands at the other side and surveys the row. And if you move a muscle, they'll kill you, right? You know, so it's like if you just lean forward, you're dead, right? If you just sort of adjust your, it's like don't move a muscle, you know. So the jikijitsu starts at the altar and he goes down. And of course, just knowing you're being watched creates tension, right? You know, so here he comes, you know, and you can hear the robe swishing, right? Swish, swish, swish. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh God, you know, foot, don't move, you know, don't move. Giant, you know, and so he goes down the altar, down the aisle, right? And then he looks. And then he goes down the other aisle, and he goes down up and down each aisle, and he's just watching to see somebody get out of line. See, this creates tremendous stress, in my opinion. And indeed, that's what it's designed to do. Anyway, you know, it would inevitably be the case that at some point my foot would just start like vibrating like a fish out of water, you know. And of course, he would see me moving and hear this, "Don't move!" And then, of course, he'd come over and. You know, and so this would just be, you know, this went on for, fortunately he wasn't always there, but this went on for a long time. It took me a long time to be able to sit comfortably in the full lotus. And I don't know how long, but a long time to be natural on the cushion, yeah? And then, you know, koan training and breath perception is the first koan. And basically, your teacher asks you to observe the breath. Now, usually in koans, there's some kind of a trick or some kind of there's something that doesn't meet the eye in most koans. There's a punchline you have to be in deep samadhi to get, you know. Teacher says, I want you to practice breath perception meditation. I want you to watch the breath. And, you know, you sit on the cushion. First of all, I myself thought, watch the breath? You know, what a disappointment. What a bummer, as we used to say. You know? I want advanced teachings, right? I want the advanced teachings. This is for babies. I know how to breathe, you know. So watch your breath. And you think, what could be more obvious than watching the breath, right? But really, I mean, I'm not giving it away. The teacher's waiting to see if you can enter deep samadhi, deep concentration, right? And a lot of people at first, when they sit on the cushion, they try to watch the breath, but they just have lots of thoughts, right? Memory or, you know, all kinds of things going on, but it's very hard for them to watch the breath. And this can go on for years, actually, you know. And in my case, I went on for years. I would sit on the cushion and sit there and say, okay, I'm watching the breath, now what, you know? And then I'd sit there and think, well, what is Zen practice anyway? What is Zen, you know? And I'd think about the stuff I'd read on Zen and think maybe this is a test, you know, maybe the teacher wants me to challenge him. You know, when I go into Dokusan, I'll say, you know, I'm not doing the breath koan, or, you know, I think of something to say in there that, and I think about what would be a good answer, you know. So I actually did go through a period where I was trying to be creative. I thought maybe creativity is what Zen is all about, you know. So I would take things into Dokusan, flowers, rock, you know, sandwich. Given, you know, it's like maybe he wants me to be creative, you know. This went on for years, right? Literally. I mentioned before that when my teacher came from Japan, my first teacher, it was like in Seattle, Zen was very big. There were lots of people who were sort of hippies or ex-hippies, and Zen was just the thing for all those ex-hippies. So when Genki Roshi came, we would have 50 people in the Dokusan room. I mean, 50 people in the Zendo. And, you know, basically, we all got the same koan at the same time. We were all told breath perception. And then we started having these retreats. We'd go to Sesshin, and people would regularly answer their koans, and I was doing breath perception for years and years. So, you know, Zen is difficult, and it's not the way you might think. It's not like you're going to sit on the cushion and begin to have marvelous or mystical experiences, or be transported to another dimension or something like that. That just doesn't happen, you know. If you want those kinds of experiences, probably Zen is not the right place to be. Instead, you know, for a long time, you have to struggle with your body, you have to struggle with your mind, and things don't go the way you necessarily want them to. Every koan is difficult. You know, you might think that if you could just answer your koan, the other koans would be easier. Especially this is true with the mu koan. After people work with the breath for a certain amount of time, the teacher will ask them to work with what's called the mu koan. This is where you sit and you, on your exhalation, you say mu, which means nothingness in Japanese, or u in Chinese. So you sit, and each time you breathe out, you say mu, mu, see? And something's supposed to happen. But it can be years. In fact, generally speaking, the mu koan takes years to work through, you know? And it's a long and difficult process. But when you get through the mu koan, that's supposed to be the toughest koan. That's the foundation of all subsequent Zen practice. So then you think, okay, that was hell, but the rest is going to be easy, see? And then your teacher gives you a koan, and what do you know? You're bumping up against a brick wall again. Again, it's just like mu. See, every koan is like that, you know? You keep bumping up against a big wall in yourself, in your mind, in your perceptions, you know? So far, what I've said probably doesn't sound very inviting, you know? Probably doesn't sound very much like something a person might want to do. You know, struggling with your body for 3 or 4 years, just trying to be able to make it sit properly on the cushion. Struggling with your mind for that same period of time. And then working with these koans, where every one is just... Somebody came up to me and said, you know, I just don't know what the heck I'm doing. This is somebody who's been practicing for 5 years and said, I just don't have any idea what I'm doing with my koan. And of course, when people say that, I'm delighted, right? I mean, that's just wonderful. But, you know, it seems so frustrating. We're trying to become experts at answering our koans, but every koan takes you right back to, like, elementary school again. So this is really very much the world of Zen, and you might think that when you have your Dai Kensho experience, see, also, it's going to all be smooth sailing from then on. Well, at least when I have my great enlightenment experience, my great awakening experience, it's all going to be smooth sailing. But you know, actually, even that's not so. You have it's hard work. Yeah? So, this is like the truth about Zen. And it requires a great application, great determination. But there's something about it that it's not everybody's cup of tea, but there's something about it that's really quite wonderful. You know, I mean, I've been doing this for 30 years. I get up every day and I do my meditation. Now, I have to tell you, it's pretty wonderful now, pretty easy now. It's pretty easy for me to arrange my body properly. It's pretty easy for me to enter empty mind and stay there for long periods of time. But there's other challenges, you know. But there's something about the experience, this kind of experience, which is very liberating, you know. You're sitting on the cushion, and you can't get quite comfortable. You know, you can't quite get comfortable. You can't quite stabilize your mind, and you keep struggling and struggling and struggling. You know, but what often happens is all of a sudden, it's like everything drops away, and there are suddenly like no obstacles in any direction. It's just like suddenly, it's like. When I was an assistant professor, when I first came to Rutgers, I was an assistant professor. And as an assistant professor at a place like Rutgers, you're told, first month I was here at Rutgers, the chairman of the department called me in. And he said, unless you publish a book and 3 articles in major journals in your field, there's no chance that you'll get tenure here. There was another woman who came with me, another colleague. And when she left the office, she said, she's a good friend of mine, she said she went back to her office and cried. It was so scary. And I too was very scared, you know, after listening to the chairman, who was this mean old man, as a matter of fact. Since retired, fortunately, he's gone. But the point is, you know, it was like at that moment, you know, I have 5 years to get this stuff done. And so you're under tremendous pressure, right? Because you write an article, you send it out, and it gets rejected. So, you know, it can take a year to write an article, see, easily. See, you know, you write it, you send it out, it gets rejected. Okay, that's a year. So then you revise it, you send it out, might take 6 more months. See, the clock is ticking, and you're trying to get 3 of these things accepted somewhere decent. See? Meanwhile, you know, you're writing this book, and you're trying to finish this book, and it's your first book, so you don't quite know how to write a book, you know. And you get that done, and you hope to get that done in time, because if you don't get it done, you're out. And if you get it done, you've got to find a press, a publisher who wants to publish it. So you send all these letters out to publishers, and each day, you know, you come home and the rejection slip is on the table, right? The letter of rejection. So, you know, at some point, you just say, you know, I don't care. And at some point, you believe it in your whole being. You know, you try and you try and you try and you try. And then at some point, you just let it all go. And it's the strangest thing, because when you let it all go, it's like you become part of the whole universe. If you've been doing Zen practice for any length of time, you know what I'm talking about. You're sitting on the cushion, you're struggling with your back, you're struggling with your legs, you're trying to focus your mind. Trying and you're trying and you're trying and you're trying, and then all of a sudden it's like, screw it. You know? It's like your whole being says, screw it. You know? And suddenly it's like everything falls away and it's like harmony. It's like the whole universe is just unfolding in this beautiful way. You know? And that can happen, you know, that happens to people. It's like in the middle of like the hurricane, or the middle of the hurricane, there's like this calm place. And you're struggling and struggling and struggling, and suddenly you just stumble into this absolutely imperturbable calm. And everywhere you look is like heaven. It's just like perfection. Right? This happens to people. Yeah. It happens off the cushion to people. It happens in their lives. You know, you just reach a point where you say, I've done everything I can to get tenure. I've worked my ass off. And you know what? It's a beautiful day. You know, it's what a beautiful day. This is such a beautiful morning. Yeah? And if you try to feel that way, it doesn't work, right? But at some point, it just happens to you. At some point, you just let it go. And it's very hard for humans to let go, to really let go. But when you do let go, it's just beautiful, right? So you know, there's a way of doing anything. And I guess you could say Zen is really about that. It's like how to do anything. You know, Zen is really about how to try and how to let go. And when you try hard and then you let go, you and the universe, you know, become one. It's like the barriers, the boundaries all disappear and you just become one. And there's this beautiful, beautiful connectedness. Yeah? Beautiful connectedness. It's like there's a phrase that is a little bit kind of philosophical, so probably in Zen we wouldn't really use it, but there was a philosopher I like who just died. His name was Richard Rorty, and he has a little essay in which he talks about what he calls self-overcoming. Now, Rorty wasn't a Buddhist, but he knew what this experience was like, you know? It's like when we're in ourselves, we have all these obstacles, all these barriers, you know? And we're afraid, we're nervous, we're worried about success and failure, right and wrong. And Rorty says, you know, every once in a while we can do something that is sort of beyond us, beyond our abilities. And then there's this beautiful, he understood this experience of, it's like the self-overcoming the self. And this is like the method of Zen, right? You know, you sit on the cushion, your legs hurt, you can't focus your mind, you try. And then all of a sudden, boom, it's like everything drops away and you're part of the universe. You can't make it happen, but when it happens, it's real. It's real. It's like all of our imaginary structures. You know, it doesn't, I mean, look, I have a lifetime job. You know, that's pretty good, right? But if I hadn't gotten tenure, it wouldn't have been the end of my life. It really wouldn't. It would have gone to another university. It wouldn't have been as good as Rutgers, but I would have gotten another job. You know, I wouldn't have starved to death and so on. It would have been difficult, you know, because nobody likes to move. Nobody likes to pack up all their stuff. It would have been embarrassing not to get tenure, but it wouldn't have been the end of the world. I put so much importance on this event, but really, all that important is actually quite imaginary. It's really quite imaginary. It's something humans have created that's really not real, but it's like a symbolic reality that we create for ourselves, and then we kind of make ourselves a prisoner of it, right? You know, we set a goal for ourselves, and in a way that can become a real prison, you know. So you know, you could make yourself really unhappy trying to get tenure. You can make yourself really unhappy trying to be prize-winning journalist. You can make yourself really unhappy trying to be a top businessman, you know. There's a way of trying, which is, like I say, you know, you try and you try and you try, but at some point, you know, you experience this self-overcoming, and it's just beautiful. I hope this makes some sense. You know? There's a way of doing things, which is the natural way, you know, And in Chinese, they have a saying, a phrase, it's called Uwei, Uwei. See, it means, you could translate it as try but don't try, or try but let go. See, try but let go. And it's like in archery, you know, we have, in archery, if you work with a bow and arrow, you have to draw the bow, right? You have to pull that bow, and the string gets tighter and tighter the more pressure you exert. You know, if you don't pull the string, if you don't make an effort, nothing's going to happen. But making the effort isn't good enough to hit the target. No matter how good your effort, you may not hit the target. See, so at some point, you just have to say, I'm going to let the arrow go, and where it goes is okay. See, and then you let the arrow go, and it goes where it's going to go. And that's your life, right? That's your karma. That's your fate. That's your life. And if you're still very fearful, very boxed in, very trapped in yourself, then, you know, basically, if the arrow doesn't hit the target, you can cry, you can throw yourself on the ground, you can beat yourself on the head. But there's a kind of, there's a way to let the arrow go where you just say, okay, I've done my very best, and now where the arrow goes is going to be wonderful no matter what happens. And when you really feel that way in your heart, you can begin to learn from where the arrow goes, see. I mean, life doesn't do what we want it to do, but what it does is actually always much more interesting, you know, actually, usually much better for us than what we wanted. So Zen practice is like this. You know, it's like you encounter an obstacle in yourself, and you push against that obstacle until something in yourself just disappears. It's like you disappear. And suddenly everything you behold is your true nature. It's like connection to the universe. See? This is Uwei. Uwei. So we all came here to practice this morning, and maybe it was a big struggle. Maybe you were able to have a little taste of true nature today. But if you keep practicing, you know, you learn how to you can become accustomed to this process, right? You become accustomed to this process, self-overcoming. So, and you realize, you know, just how wonderful it is if you just hang in there long enough to experience the walls going down. And when they go down, it's heaven itself. So, you get up the next day, and what do you know, the walls are back up. Yeah? But you sit down on the cushion again, boom, and those walls go down, and it's like everything is holy, everything is alive, really beautiful. So as I say, this isn't everybody's cup of tea. But if you've gone through this process a couple of times, it can become very very persuasive, you know, mm-hmm. Very beautiful way to live. Umon said, "The world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell?" Mumon's comment: in studying Zen, you should not be swayed by sounds and forms. Even though you attain insight when hearing a voice or seeing a form, this is simply the ordinary way of things. Don't you know that real Zen students command sound, control forms, are clear-sighted at every event and free on every occasion? Granted you are free, just tell me. Does the sound come to the ear, or does the ear go to the sound? If both sound and silence die away, at such a juncture, how could you talk of Zen? While listening with your ear, you cannot tell. And hearing with your eye, you are truly intimate. This is like a great koan. It's just wonderful. In studying Zen, you should not be swayed by sound and forms. Even though you attain insight when hearing a voice or seeing a form, this is simply the ordinary way of things. Don't you know that real Zen students command sound, control form? Then he says, granted, you're free already. See, now you listen to this koan and you think, wait a minute. I am swayed by sound and forms. I don't have any of these experiences he's describing. I'm not free, right? So you start worrying about it. It's a beautiful koan. You say, boy, hearing with your eye, seeing with your ear, oh, that would be so cool, right? So you sit there and think, hearing, I'm going to wait. Am I seeing with my ear? You know, you sit and work. Hours go by, days go by, months go by. You know? At some point, you just go, oh, screw it. This beautiful world. Oh my God, this moment is so beautiful. It's so alive. You know, you say, to hell with Master Uma. This is heaven. So the koan, that's how this devilish little koans works. To hell with hearing with your eye and seeing with your ear. That's in English it's called a come on. Right? Saying, please realize your true freedom, your true nature. We have to bash ourselves into a number of walls before they dissolve, because we created them ourselves. Yes? With realization, things make one family. Have you got it? With realization, things make one family. Okay, I'm learning now something about Zen. Without realization, things are separated in a thousand ways. Okay, realization, unity. No realization, separation. Got it. But then Momon says, oh, but without realization, unity. With realization, very clever. These ancient masters were quite clever. So you sit and say, unity, realization, unity, realization. You know, winter turns into spring. Spring turns into summer. Summer turns into fall, and you're still sitting there. Unity, realization. Where is it? And then one day, screw it. Beautiful. Beautiful. This beautiful life. This beautiful.